Welcome to my talk today. So it's actually good to be back in Kiel. I don't know. I don't think that anybody of you has heard or has been in the talk I've given here around about 2 years ago. So for these people who don't know me yet, as you can see here, I'm from the Technical University of Vienna, and today I'm going to do some talk on some of my research. But however, let me first introduce myself a little bit to you. So actually, originally I'm also from the northern part of Germany, but not as northern as Kiel is. So originally I studied in Oldenburg. Yeah, so did my bachelor in computer science and a diploma in economics. So I have to admit that I'm also a business guy. And actually the very first job I ever had at a university was as a teaching assistant for software engineering back with Willy Hasselbrink. Yeah, because Professor Hasselbrink back then was still in Oldenburg, but he left, and so at some point of time I said, okay, if Willy Hasselbrink leaves, then I should leave as well. No, it wasn't like that. Nevertheless, I moved on from Oldenburg during my, let's say, undergrad studies. Also went to Australia for a time, and actually there at the University of Newcastle, with Newcastle being a little town, 100 kilometers to the north of Sydney roundabout, there I did actually my Master in Computer Science, or more precisely, Master of Information Technology. And already pretty early during my studies, I came to the conclusion that I want to stay in research, and in the best case, I want to stay in academia. So the first thing I wanted to do after getting my master diploma and bachelor and whatever, was to actually, of course, pursue a PhD. For that, I moved on again, went to the Technical University of Darmstadt, where I was from 2006 to 2010, first as a PhD student, and then 2010 to mid of 2011 as a postdoc and group head. And after that, I moved on to Vienna, in beautiful Vienna in Austria, where I first was a postdoc. My original plan was actually to stay only for 1 or 2 years and then come back to Germany, but that was in 2011, so I'm still there. And since then, so I became first, so I was there first as a postdoc, then as an assistant professor, now as an associate professor, so it doesn't seem as if I will ever leave Vienna again. Who knows? And in Vienna, I've got a little research group within the distributed systems group, and made up from 6 PhD students, and we are working on different topics. Just want to give you a brief overview of the research topics we are working on. Originally, I'm from the field of service-oriented computing, so web services, these days microservices, and so on. So this is where I did my PhD. And also after my PhD, I worked a little bit in this area, but then around about 7-8 years ago, I decided that I should go for some other area and moved on to the field of cloud computing, or more precisely, elastic computing. And we will actually see a little bit of elastic computing today as well. So elasticity actually means that you are able to increase the computational resources which you need in a system based on the demand. Yeah, just think about, for example, Netflix. Yeah, so Netflix over the day has a very has peak hours and not so peak hours. Yeah, for example, when it's getting late afternoon or the evening in the US, then Netflix has at some point 30 million users which they have to serve at the same point of time. During other times of the day, they've got only around about 10 million users. Yeah, so this is the reason why Netflix, for example, massively uses elastic computing, which means they simply lease computational resources from Amazon in order to be able to meet the demands of all the customers they've got. Yeah, and that's the basic idea of elastic computing, so that we are able to add computational resources and that we are able to release these computational resources later on again. And as you can see here, I've done some work in this area, for example, with regard to business processes, and then we call them elastic processes. Part of this has been done in cooperation with Professor Koschmider here from University of Kiel. I've also done some work in the field of fog computing, which we will see a little bit more detail today, and also elastic stream processing, which means if there are data streams, how can we actually process them in time? And especially these last two areas, so fog computing and elastic stream processing, is not only part of my research on elastic computing, but also part of my research on the Internet of Things, yeah, because a lot of these cases we actually take into account, okay, we've got the IoT, we've got a lot of different data sources, they are emitting data over time, how can we actually make sure that we can process the data, communicate the data, store the data, and so on. Other areas I'm working on in this field are, for example, cognitive systems, and these days the biggest research topic of my group are blockchain technologies, where I originally worked on the application of blockchain technologies in different use case areas, again processes for example, but this has shifted to quite some degree, so these days we are really doing basic research in the field of blockchain. So for example, in the field of blockchain interoperability, I don't know, you all know what the blockchain is in theory. In theory, everybody knows that. You may also know that blockchains are actually closed worlds. Yeah? So the Bitcoin blockchain is completely different world from the Ethereum blockchain, for example. And we are taking into account how can we actually bridge this gap between the different blockchains. And a lot of this fundamental research which I'm doing here, or which I'm doing in the different fields, is actually sponsored or is actually funded by projects which have some particular application area. Yeah? And here two application areas have been in my focus in the last years. So on the one hand, the industrial internet, or what we call Industry 4.0, so in German, Industry 4.0. So actually the digitalization of the production, production industry or the manufacturing industry. And actually a lot of the projects I'm working on, yeah, for example, these are all European projects I have been part of, or which I am still part of. And as you can see, for example, Adventure Fora and Crema are all from the field of industrial internet. And Simplicity, the one you can see at the left-hand side, is from the field of smart mobility, which is my second major research area or application area. Yeah? And today, what I'm going to present to you, I can't present everything to you, but we've got a little bit of time, so what I'm going to present to you is some of the research in this field of industrial internet and especially for computing. And this is research which is partially funded by the FORA project, which actually means FOG Computing for Robotics and Automation, which is coincidentally also the title of my talk today. So, what is in the agenda for today? Yeah? So today we are going to talk about robotics. We are going to talk about that robotics emit a lot of data and that we need to find a way to actually take care of this data. Yeah? So, which means how do we process the data, how do we store this data. And for that, yeah, we will first start with an overall motivation, and then we will discuss two different approaches. On the one hand, the usage of cloud computing for robotics and for other IoT devices as well. So I've got a data source in the IoT, how can I make use of cloud computing? And actually, why may it not be the very best idea to actually use cloud computing with IoT? There are different reasons for that. We are going to discuss that as well. And because of these shortcomings, we will discuss a second approach, which is called FOC and edge computing. So I have seen that Professor Landsiedel is also doing an Internet of Things course here, but I think he only starts with that in summer. So has anybody ever heard anything about the Internet of Things in a lecture? Nobody? One? A little bit, okay, good. Cloud computing, good. I've got some backup slides for that. don't worry. If you don't understand something, yeah, just interrupt me. That's really fine. Yeah, I don't feel offended if students actually ask me questions. So, what are actually then our learning objectives? Yeah, so what should you actually take with you today? So, first of all, you should understand the role of cloud computing in the Internet of Things. So why might cloud computing actually be a good idea in the IoT? You should be able to discuss both the benefits and the shortcomings of cloud computing in the IoT. And then, yeah, you should at least understand what fog computing is all about and how you can actually apply that. Nevertheless, this talk primarily aims at robotics. So let us start with a brief motivation, yeah, and ask ourselves the questions. Why do we actually need something like fog computing, edge computing, or also cloud computing in robotics or in robotic systems? So if you take a look at shop floors, yeah, so die Werkshalle, yeah, in a lot of companies, doesn't matter if we are talking about large automotive companies, like, Volkswagen, for example, or if we are talking about these hidden champions, of which we've got quite a lot in Germany, so rather small companies which nevertheless are world leading. What we see these days is that, of course, a lot of the production processes are actually automated. So we've got really a lot of robots on the shop floor. The reason for that is pretty simple. Labor in Germany is expensive. It's the same in Austria. So in order to keep the value adding in Germany, the manufacturing in Germany or in Europe in general, you need to automate the processes. This means, in a lot of cases, we automate as much as we can, including some things which might have been done by people, by workers in the past, but these days it's done by industrial robots. I don't know if you can actually see that because the resolution is not too bad, but what is actually missing on this picture? There's no human being around. So there are only robots on the shop floor. There are no human beings around for two reasons. First of all, it's way too dangerous. If you are hit by such a robot in the head, you are pretty much dead. Because they really are strong. They have a lot of force. Actually, this is the reason why the robots are, let's say, in a cage. So the human beings are only allowed to watch them through some windows, as you can see here on the other side. However, the other reasons why there is no human being here around is because everything is automated. You don't need the human being any longer. You may need the human being, if at all, in order to get a working piece from one robot to the other, but even that can be automated. So even that might not be necessary. And robots do a lot of stuff. So if you ever have the chance to do a trip to Volkswagen in Wolfsburg, for example, so you will see robots which press, which cut, which stamp, which weld. So they really do a lot of different things, and these might even be the same robots, actually. They are just programmed to do different tasks in such a manufacturing process or in such a manufacturing workflow. A robot may look like that, so that's a pretty cool standard layout for a robot. You've got actually different axes, so the robot can move into different dimensions, as you can see here. The robot can pick something, and it's actually pretty strong, so as I said, and it can rotate and everything, and as I said, if it rotates, you should rather be very careful that you don't come too close to it. So now in the industrial internet, one thing which we want to achieve is something which we call the digitalization of manufacturing processes. So what could that be? For example, it could actually mean this robot is working on a workpiece. And we actually see, we've got, a temperature sensor here. And at the end of the day, we realize, the robot today has worked on 100 different working pieces, and only 20 of them are broken. We can't use them any longer. So, good thing is, now let's simply assume they can't be used any longer, so they are faulty, for example, because the temperature within the robot or within the working piece got too hot. And the basic idea of digitalization in manufacturing processes is now actually that we take into account data sources which we've got, for example, here our little temperature sensor, and see, what is the reason why working piece 18 to 37 are broken? And identify that. Why do we want to identify that? In order to avoid that something like that happens in the future again. Because next time the temperature is too high, what would we do? Would we continue to work on our working pieces? No, we would stop the production and fix the robot, or let it cool off or whatever, in order to actually see, order to make sure that the working pieces are not broken any longer. And this information might even be important for the process planning. So now imagine, for example, a company like, let's take an automotive company again. Automotive company, Audi, for example. A car is made up from, any idea how many different parts? 5,000? More than 5,000? Who says more than 5,000? Don't be shy. Who says more than 15,000? Only one is left. Who says round about 2? It's actually around about 30,000 different parts. So a typical a typical car. I don't know about a Tesla. Yeah, there might be even more pieces or less. I don't know. But yeah, Volkswagen or Toyota, 30,000 parts. That's what we've got. And you know that these manufacturing processes are very optimized. Yeah, so this means if something breaks down or if something doesn't go as planned, this may lead to a cascade of failures in the process. So this robot doesn't get a piece right. Yeah? Which actually means that 20 other robots which should work on the same piece or use that piece and so on later on in the process have to wait. Yeah? Which is a waste of resources. Yeah? So they don't think because they cannot work, they are working for a working piece. So actually getting the information from the robot, temperature is too high, we cannot use this working piece, we need to wait until the working piece or the robot has cooled down. Yeah? Could be very interesting actually to replan things, because if we know, okay, there is a particular working piece will not arrive now in time for the next steps, what do? We do some other steps first. Yeah, we don't wait for that. Yeah, so there shouldn't be a gap. So this is very good in order to optimize production. And actually, robots, of course, don't only have one sensor. Yeah, so of course, such a robot is most likely equipped with 80 to 200, maybe 300 different sensors, not only temperature, but also, for example, pressure, the axis tilt, the rotation, or any other sensors which could be an important or could play an important role. Yeah, and each of these sensors is actually now a data source. So of course, the robot is a data source, and the robot gives information about different aspects, different phenomena of itself and about the working piece, which may play a role. No? So, this said, yeah, a robot is not some, let's say, standalone unit which is somewhere on the shop floor and just working on a piece. Instead, based on the data sources, it becomes integrated in manufacturing processes. And that's why we call this not only a robot, instead, it is a cyber-physical production system. Yeah? So it is what we call a smart, you can actually argue if it's really smart or not, but it's for sure an interconnected manufacturing asset. It doesn't stand there on its own. It's connected to other assets, connected to a database, connected to an ERP system, and so on. It features sensors, as you can see here, and of course it also features actuators, which actually change something. Yeah? In a robot, that's pretty simple to see. Yeah, or the all the things we need for the rotation, for pressure and so on are, of course, putting or using actuators. And so the robot, the cyber-physical production system, therefore collects data and influences processes, as we have just said. And now we could, of course, say, okay, how much data is this actually? Yeah, so typical, rather simple robot I have seen at one of my project partners in Spain actually emits 90 megabytes of data per minute. So, and we as computer scientists, we actually say, well, 90 megabytes of data, that's not too much, yeah? I mean, we can handle that. That's not a problem at all. However, 90 megabytes of data per minute means more than 20 gigabytes of data per day if we really run the robot the whole day. And the problem is, of course, we don't only have one robot on the shop floor. We actually got a dozen of them, or in very large companies, yeah, hundreds maybe of them. And we are, of course, not so much interested in all of the raw data which is coming here, yeah, from the sensor. So in case everything is fine, we don't care if the temperature here is 21 degrees or 23 degrees. But in case something goes wrong, then it's actually interesting to see, okay, which data may now indicate what went wrong. Was it really the temperature which was too high, or was it the pressure? So what is the reason that our working piece is broken, yeah, so that we cannot use it any longer because it's faulty. So is it the temperature? Is it the pressure? Or whatever reason for that? And that's actually the interesting part of it. Yeah, finding the needle in the haystack. So these 20 gigabytes of data are a lot of data which is not interesting. But we need this little data items, these little events which actually tell us why something went wrong. So what is this robot as well? It is, of course, an Internet of Things device. So if you've got the chance to go to the Internet of Things lecture of Professor Landsiedel next semester, please do it. Yeah. So I love the topic. So what is actually the Internet of Things? And I don't have a slide on that. But in general, yeah, such a robot is an Internet of Things device, for example, because it is connected to some network. It has computational capabilities. It has maybe some storage capabilities. It has sensors. Yeah. When people discuss the Internet of Things, many talk about the smart fridge, for example. Has anybody ever heard about the smart fridge? Yes, it's a very common example. Yeah. So actually, you don't have a stupid fridge at home. Instead, the fridge, based on sensor technologies and a network communication, tells your supermarket that you run out of beer or run out of milk and automatically orders new beer or new milk or whatever. Yeah, things like that. Because you've got sensors, you've got computational resources, so the fridge becomes smart, more or less. Yeah. So other examples would be that the smart fridge sends you a WhatsApp message or whatever you use these days, Telegram message, and actually tells you, okay, the fish you've bought has an expiration date tomorrow. Yeah, please use the fish tomorrow. Yeah, so actually, very basic and simple example, and I'm not sure if we ever will see really something like a smart fridge, but it's actually good to exemplify what is the basic idea of the Internet of Things. And of course, again, yeah, an Internet of Things device is simply a normal device which you enrich with computation capabilities, storage capabilities, sensor capabilities, and so on. Yeah, and this robot, of course, is one of these Internet of Things devices as well. And now the question is really, okay, we've got here 20 gigabytes of data which we need to take care of. So how do we do that? Yeah? So that's my motivation or why I say, okay, fog computing is what we should use here. Yeah? So there are different options what we can do. So first of all, we can actually use the computational resources which are within the robot. That's of course possible. Yeah? However, the resources here are usually limited. Yeah? So, for example, want to store these 20 gigabytes of data completely because you want to analyze it later on, yeah? You've got some data scientists who run some algorithms on it or regression analyzes and so on it. Yeah, for example, the robot will not be able to handle this large amount of data. You need to store the data somewhere else. No? Good thing is, however, yeah, so the processing, if you use the computational resources which are within the robot, can be actually done very, very quickly. So because the data does not have to travel a lot. So the data is here on site, the computational resources are on site, yeah, it's processed here, everything is fine. Yeah? However, on the other side, we've got only limited resources here. Completely opposite direction would actually to make use of the cloud or, yeah, in the best case or in the worst case, depending on your how you see things, in the public cloud. Yeah, so you actually say, okay, I actually don't want to build my own big data center which takes care of that because I'm building machines. I have no idea about computers and, yeah, I'm not sure if this whole Industry 4.0 thing really will ever take off. So somebody else should take care of the computational resources. I don't want to build my own data center. I want to build machines or I want to use these robots. So what you could, of course, do is you can go to Amazon, to Google, to Microsoft, also to a lot of smaller, also to German cloud providers and say, okay, I need storage from you or I need virtual machines, so computational resources, computing power, RAM, and so on from you. Good thing here, you've got virtually unlimited resources. Yeah, it's nearly impossible that somebody will ever use the complete computation resources Amazon or Google offer in their clouds. Yeah, it's simply not possible. It's just they offer just too much. Yeah, so a lot of resources. However, on the downside, of course, companies are usually not so keen on giving their raw data to such a cloud provider. Because you don't know what they will do with that. So even if you say, okay, I trust Amazon or I trust Google, so I can store the data there, you should be, for example, aware that with the so-called Cloud Act in the US, so the United States, actually the US government or also the NSA and the FBI and you name it, is actually allowed to tell Amazon, give me all of the data you've got about a particular customer, Stefan Schulte, for example. Show me which data Stefan Schulte has stored in your cloud. Yeah? And they are even allowed to do that, so the US government and governmental agencies, to do that if the resources are actually not in the US. So even if I make use of virtual machines and storage in Amazon, which Amazon also has in Germany next to Frankfurt, Cloud Act actually says Amazon, nevertheless, as a US-based company, has to give the US government my data. Yeah? So, and for companies, this is pretty much, of course, a nightmare, because you don't want, because you don't want to give away your data, even if it's a lot of data, yeah, and because this data gives a lot of information. For example, how long has the robot been run? Yeah, so are there any problems with the robot? Yeah? Things like that. Yeah, so this is the opposite. So data protection concerns. And on the other hand, latency may also play a role. So if you upload, so let's assume, this is a robot, this is our data source, it's connected to a network in your company on your shop floor, and then the data is sent to Amazon, yeah, maybe next to Frankfurt, doesn't take too much time. It's processed there and then actually sent back to you. So this may take round about, let's say, on average, maybe 80 milliseconds. Yeah? So, of course, depending on how much processing you do on site in Frankfurt. But the sending back and forth, the latency, maybe 80 milliseconds in average case. But this also means that in some cases it may take maybe half a second, yeah? Or 300 milliseconds, something like that, or even longer. And even in the industrial internet, there are some use cases. Yeah, so I'm working with a company in Austria who have an example of that, where they measure in one of their machines the pressure. So, and if the pressure is too high, they need to shut down the machine within 200 milliseconds. Yeah, so that's their cutoff. In that case, they see the pressure is too high, the machine directly is cut down 200 milliseconds. If it takes more than 200 milliseconds, there is a big risk that that one of the parts which actually got too much pressure pretty much explodes, yeah, and then destroys way more of the machine. So for them, for example, sending the data to the cloud is simply not an option, because even if the average case is only 80 milliseconds, yeah, they cannot risk that it takes longer to send the data to the Amazon cloud, process it in there, and send it back. So what they need to do is they need to do the data processing on site. Yeah? So in the industrial internet, this is a very common problem. Also, just think about in the future, 10 years, we will have a lot of autonomous cars in the streets. Yeah? And where do autonomous cars actually decide what to do next? Yeah? Actually, there were some early proposals where it was also said, yeah, with 5G and everything, we will simply send all of the data to the cloud, it will be processed there, and then, yeah, we will tell the cars what to do. But, I mean, imagine German highway, yeah, people going with 200 kilometers per hour, on the street, it might actually be not a good idea to add 80 milliseconds of latency on top of the data processing, because 80 milliseconds actually may mean the difference between an accident or not. So, therefore the question is, okay, we've got only limited computation resources on site, we've got on the other hand the public cloud, where can we process the data else? Yeah, can we process it somewhere in between, or can we actually process it somewhere or partially in the robot, within the IoT device, or the cyber physical production system, whatever you want to call it, and partially in the cloud, depending on the data, depending on the use case. And for that, yeah, we will actually have first a look at how we could make use of the cloud for that. Huh? So, and in general, as I said before, what we have seen or what we are discussing today and what I'm also working on in one of my research projects is that we take this into account for robots. Robots as data sources. But actually, yeah, it can be generalized to any IoT device, because in the IoT, we've got a lot of data sources. In fact, not only in the industrial internet. Yeah. So Cisco actually said 4 years ago, so Cisco as the biggest network equipment provider in the world, said already 4 years ago that this year in 2020, we will have 50 billion internet-connected devices. And of course, a lot of these internet-connected devices are your smartphone, your laptop, yeah, so servers, normal desktop PCs, and so on. Yeah, but it is estimated that around about 30 billion of these internet-connected devices are actually IoT devices. And actually, this may sound like a lot, but just think about how many internet-connected devices you've already got today in your environment. Yeah, so, for example, one example, the smart grids of the future. Yeah, so with the change from the old energy grid to the smart energy grid, what actually happens is, yeah, in the past we had some nuclear power plants, some gas-based power plants, some coal-based power plants, and so on, and it was actually quite easy to keep the power grid in balance. These days, however, we've got a lot of windmills, yeah, especially here in the northern part, very nice, yeah, so nice clean power sources. We've got solar panels, yeah, we've got water-based power plants and so on. And then, which actually means we've got a lot of small power providers. And in order to keep the grid in balance, this actually means that we need to have sensors everywhere and see where is data produced, where is it consumed, and actually try to balance out the grid. Yeah? So we've got a lot of these internet-connected devices in the smart grid. We also got a lot of these internet-connected devices in smart factories. We've just seen that robots, but also RFID-based supply chain systems, other stuff. Or at home, just think about how many internet-connected devices you've got at home. Yeah, so of course you've got a laptop. You've got some game machine. Yeah, I don't know, like an Xbox or a Nintendo Switch. Yeah. In many cases these days, your TV will for sure be connected to the internet. Yeah. Either directly or not. Yeah. So my home, even my vacuum cleaner is connected to the internet for whatever reason. Yeah. But what I've got at home as well is that actually my heating, I can actually control my heating from my smartphone and actually tell my heating in Vienna that it should actually now make the bathroom warm for whatever reason, but I could actually do it. Yeah, so a lot of devices are in the internet. So if you have a smart speaker, so an Amazon Echo or something similar, it's in the internet as well. Yeah, so you've got here again a lot of internet connected devices. And a lot of them, again, are actually emitting data. They are data sources, and we need to take into account that we need to process this data. And last but not least, I've just mentioned it, smart transport networks. Yeah, so an average car already today has around about 200 sensors. A lot of data is actually generated within a car. And in the future, with autonomous cars, yeah, the number of sensors will be even bigger, and especially the need for exchanging data with other cars, for example, or with roadside units will grow to quite some degree. Yeah? Also, the environment, so the infrastructure is these days very often equipped with sensors. Yeah? So in Austria, for example, the highways are equipped with sensors in order to see if the streets are in a good shape. Or just think about sensors which you can use in order to identify if a parking spot is empty, or sensor data induction loops which you have in front of traffic lights. So, and all of these, yeah, so around about 30 billion of these internet-connected devices this year are IoT devices, yeah, which actually means they generate data and we need to take care of that data somehow. So, McKinsey, this well-known consulting company, actually said that in 2025, we will even have 1 trillion internet-connected devices, with most of them being IoT devices. And 1 trillion, that's a 1 with 12 zeros, yeah? Which actually means with 8 billion people on planet Earth, doesn't mean if it's a baby or if it's a very old person, yeah, there will be 125 internet-connected devices per person. Doesn't matter if that person is, so on average, of course, yeah, doesn't matter if that person is on is in Germany or in a rural area in a third world country. Yeah, so really on average. So I'm curious if that number will really, if that will really happen. 1 trillion is really a lot. But the number of internet-connected devices even increases more. And again, the question is, how do we actually process this, these huge amounts of data then? Yeah? So, because a lot of these IoT devices are not very powerful, they are little sensor nodes. Yeah? So they've got a little bit of sensor capabilities, a little bit of computational capabilities, but that's pretty much it. Yeah? You cannot really run extensive programs on them. Yeah? So little sensor nodes are just not able to do that. Therefore, a couple of years ago, people said, yeah, well, we simply make use of cloud computing to process these huge amounts of data. Yeah, so we simply go to the cloud, go to Amazon, for example, and then we can use actually well-known well-known big data software or data engineering software in order to more make or carry out software functionalities which cannot be carried out within a single device. Yeah, for example, we can make something like complex analysis, batch processing by using a solution like Apache Hadoop and MapReduce or Apache Spark, which are these days standard technologies, also used by large internet companies like Facebook, for example, or Twitter and so on, to actually find out everything about us. Yeah? So analyze the users, analyze the huge amounts of data which they have about us, and can also be used for IoT devices, yeah, to actually check. For example, a couple of years ago, I was in a project with the city of Dublin, and the city of Dublin has around about 10,000 traffic sensors within the city. So they made use of such programs in order to identify, okay, where are traffic jams, where are congestions, can we actually prediction where a traffic jam might be at a certain point of time. For that, they also made use of such software. Yeah? Can also make use of data mining, yeah, using solution like Apache Mahoo together with Apache Spark, for example, or also real-time processing of the data. Yeah, so here I talked about batch processing. That's something which you do in the middle of the night, for example, once per day, analyze things. But here we are talking about real-time processing, and this is of course very important for a lot of IoT scenarios as well, because so the city of Vienna has said, okay, we want to be a smart city. We want to avoid traffic congestions and traffic jams altogether. So they also want, based on the traffic sensors they've got, they want to analyze how much traffic is in a particular area and then control the traffic. Yeah, for example, leave the traffic lights on red for longer. Yeah, simply for the reason to stop cars of entering a particular street, as long as there is a congestion, not to make things even worse. Yeah. If you see such a use case, actually doing batch processing in the middle of the night doesn't really help at all. So because what you need then is real-time data processing, so which means you need to know now what the traffic situation is at this point of time. Yeah, you don't need to know that 2 hours later, then it's too late to do traffic control. You need to know that now, so which means within a second or maybe 1.5 seconds. So, and as I said, very often we make use of cloud computing for that. And just a brief overview of cloud computing. So, as I said, yeah, there are very large cloud providers like Amazon, Google, Strato in Germany, Microsoft, and so on. And the basic idea they offer you is, as I said before, that you can lease and release computational resources based on your demand. So, let's take a traditional data center first. So, for example, data center here in the Hochschulrechenzentrum at University of Kiel. So what do they have? Yeah, so they've got a fixed amount of IT resources. This is actually our little green line which we see here. This is our capacity. Huh? So, and the capacity is pretty much the same. Yeah, because of course, yeah, if you want to increase the capacity, this takes quite some time. Yeah, so because if you need to buy new servers, you first need to find the money for that. You need to order the servers. It takes a couple of days. Hopefully, you've got a spare room where you can set up the servers. You've got an administrator who actually takes care of setting up things, and so on and so on and so on. That may take a lot of time. So this isn't really a problem if we've got a demand for computational resources like the one we see here. Yeah, so this is, for example, also the IT resources here at the Hochschulrechenzentrum and in a lot of companies, what it looks like. Yeah, so we've got peak hours and non-peak hours. Yeah, don't know. Let's say this is Monday at 8. People arrive in the university. They need, they access the server. They need the computational resources and so on. Yeah, or let's say that's a Friday. Yeah, so this is Friday morning, and then Friday afternoon, everybody goes into the weekend. Over the weekend, the computational resources are not needed at all, unless some very smart student decided to say, our computational resources are not needed at all, so I do some Bitcoin mining on them over the weekend. Yeah, I've heard that happens from time to time. I didn't get the idea. Okay, it doesn't matter. So this is the peak hour, this is the non-peak hour, and then after the weekend, we've got the increase again. This is all fine. Yeah, so the demand is always below the capacity. Huh? However, what we all can also see here is that there is a big waste of resources. So these are resources which are paid for. They are available. The resources are there, but they are never used. Huh? So we waste money here. And of course, things get worse, or what a problem might be is if the demand actually is higher than the capacity. Yeah, so this means that our red curve would actually go over the capacity line. Yeah, so that we, yeah, our peak is somewhere here. Because what will happen then, of course, yeah, the quality of service may go down a lot, or people may not be able to actually use the systems any longer. Yeah, this might be here at the university, but especially this is a problem for companies. Yeah, you can easily imagine. This is, for example, something which companies like Amazon want to avoid at any cost. So that somebody cannot actually get on the website and spend money there. And that's actually also the reason why Amazon these days is the biggest cloud provider in the, of the world. Because Amazon's data center is equipped to take care of all the people who enter the web shop on the 22nd and 23rd of December. These are all the late buyers for the Christmas for Christmas shopping. Yeah? And the remainder of the year, yeah, these resources are not really used, or at least by far not completely, yeah, maybe 20 to 25%. They don't need more. And at some point then Amazon said, yeah, well, we've got so many spare resources, we never use them, we pay for them, why don't we actually lease them to other people? This is the basic idea where cloud computing came from. So if we then have the chance, let's say one of you has a nice web shop, it really takes off. So a lot of you've got a lot of users, but you also don't want to run your own big data center. So what do you run instead? You actually use resources from the cloud. So and the basic idea of cloud computing is then that you build a virtual data center in the cloud where the demand and capacity curves look a little bit different. Yeah? So what the aim is actually is that the demand is, yeah, that the demand is fully met, but that the capacity is just a little bit above the demand line. So the green one is here, a little bit above the capacity line, yeah, just to take care of some unexpected changes. Yeah? What is the benefit here? Of course, we don't have this big waste of resources. Yeah? So this doesn't happen. We just lease as many resources as we need. Yeah? And hopefully, we always have enough resources in place that the demand never never is bigger than the capacity which we got in place. So I don't have a figure on that, but I've just said this curve could also look like that. Yeah? And then this area where the demand exceeds the capacity, that is also something which we absolutely want to avoid. So when we now take a look at the cloud and the IoT, and think about, okay, how can cloud computing actually help the Internet of Things to process this vast amount of data, yeah, from 30 million different devices? How can we actually do that? Yeah? So, or how can we do that? So we've got the computation resources in the cloud. Yeah? Now the problem is, however, we may have enough computational resources. But on the other hand, we also got some very important differences between the IoT and the cloud. So, because the cloud is based on the idea that you are able to build very large data centers somewhere. Only if you have these very large data centers, you are actually able to provide cloud resources very, very cheaply. Yeah? So, cloud computing relies on this assumption of economies of scale, which means that it's quite expensive to have a data center with 10,000 physical machines, but it's getting way, way cheaper to add further resources, yeah, if you increase the data center. So an Amazon data center, for example, a cloud data center of Amazon, is around about 120,000 machines. Yeah, so that's what they roundabout offer you, or what they usually have. And they have got around about 20 of that all over the world. So which means cloud data centers are centralized in one area. The IoT, on the other hand, is highly distributed. So just imagine smart city of Kiel in the future, where you've got a lot of little sensors all over the city, highly distributed, yeah, and all of them are actually far away from the next very big cloud data center, which may then lead to these issues which we see with regard to latency. Yeah? Also, we clearly have to say, so I'm a distributed systems guy, and in distributed systems these days, computational resources are not so much a problem any longer. So if we take into account how the computational resources increased in the last 20 years, yeah, then the computational resources we can offer at the same cost these days are 10 raised to the power of 15 times higher than what we were able to offer 20 years ago. With computational storage, it's even better. Yeah? So with computational storage, it's 10 raised to the power of 18. Yeah? So storage is unbelievably cheap. Bandwidth, however, yeah, so in networks, has only raised or has only increased by a factor of 10,000. So which still sounds a lot, so 10 raised to the power of 4, but it's the scarce resource, it's the bottleneck we've got these days in distributed systems. The network is actually the problem. Computational resources, we've got enough of them. Storage, we've got enough of that as well. But what we don't have is bandwidth. Bandwidth is really the problem. And that's actually the reason why we want to avoid to send too much data to the cloud from our little IoT devices. Yeah, latency is a problem. Bandwidth is a problem. Then we've already talked about it. There is a certain reluctance to give data to the cloud. I completely understand that. Yeah, so for me as a researcher, it's actually quite interesting to see which data. So I've got to see which data actually is shared or is coming from my vacuum cleaner and stored at a particular cloud provider. Yeah? So I've actually got a little program which traces that and actually tells me which data is uploaded. Yeah? So it's actually interesting for me as a researcher, but I completely understand anybody who actually says, well, I don't want my data to be in a cloud in the US or in China or wherever, and I'm not sure what will be done with the data. I completely understand that, yeah? as a person. And as I've just said, for companies, it might even be a bigger problem because companies don't want to lose control over the data. Yeah? There might be business secrets in that data. You may be able to derive knowledge about the production processes, how good the company is actually performing from the data. All that is possible. Yeah? And of course, companies are not so keen on doing that. And last but not least, if we've got this scenario, so data is sourced in a decentralized way. We've got all of these little IoT sources all over the place, all over the world maybe even. Yeah? And then we send the data to a centralized cloud data center. It's processed there, stored there, there will be some result. And then the result is actually sent back to the decentralized IoT data sources in many cases, or to data stakeholders who just are close to the data sources. This doesn't really sound like it makes too much sense. Also taking into account, last item on this slide, that a lot of these 50 billion internet-connected devices, let's say 30 billion of them are IoT devices, offer us some computational resources. As I said, a lot of IoT devices are rather weak, so don't have too many computational resources. You also have to be careful because they are, for example, battery constrained, and so you have to be careful not to use too much of their battery power and so on. But nevertheless, there are other devices which are powerful, so powerful sensor nodes, gateways, routers, or smartphones, very powerful computers available at the edge of the network. So why don't we actually make use of these computational resources then, instead of sending everything to the cloud? So, and what I always do in my lectures is a little 2 to 3 minutes break, what we will do now as well, and after this break I will actually tell you how we can make use of a different approach, which is known as FOC and edge computing, in order to really make use of these resources. I hope that you were all able to think about what we've just talked about before the break. Let me now continue with the main part of our...
Did you restart?
Yes, I did. Yeah, so hopefully I'll check it again. Yeah. Okay, so the major topic of my talk today is FOC and edge computing for robotics. So now we've just seen how things are actually processed with the cloud. Yeah, we can just recapitulate that again. Yeah, so what do we got? Yeah, so let's assume these are all little IoT sensor nodes. Yeah, sensor nodes, so data sources. So highly distributed. Yeah, and what do? We take all of this data from this highly distributed network and send it to a centralized cloud. Yes, this is what we see here. And then we make some solution like Apache Spark Streaming, and process the data and send it back. So, and as I said before, sending the data back means in many cases that actually the process data is sent back to exactly these devices and or to data stakeholders which are close to these devices. So we've got a nice round trip of the data. You know, the data travels the whole world and then the process data comes back to us. So drawbacks, already said that. High link delays, so latencies, which may also be, there might be a good average, but there might be peak latencies, which might be an issue. In many IoT scenarios, we actually get a low data transfer speed. Yeah, so as I said before, if you've got the chance, go to the IoT lecture of Professor Lanzi to the next semester, because he will actually tell you that as well. A lot of IoT scenarios don't have something like a 5G network which you can use, or Wi-Fi or whatever, alone for the reason that these networks are very often resource intensive. So they need a lot of, these communication means actually need a lot of energy. And for that reason, you actually rather make use of communication standards like CoAP, for example, or MQTT for sensor networks, or LoRaWAN, which only provide you with a low data transfer speed, however, which don't use too much energy as well. Yeah. And then, what did I say as well? Just as a brief recapitulation. Yeah, we've got computational resources on these devices. Yeah. We've got computational resources on a lot of them, not on all of them, but in a lot of IoT scenarios. Yeah, I've already said gateways, routers, or you may build your own little smart home solution using something like a single board computer, like a Raspberry Pi. So, which also is not a very powerful machine, but it can do things. So, why don't we make use of these computational resources, which we've got at the edge of the network? Then, why do we actually say, okay, we should send everything to the cloud? So, and last but not least, we need to lease cloud resources. Cloud resources are pretty cheap, but nevertheless, they lead to additional cost. So why don't we then make use of the computation resources which we already have? Yeah, we are the only additional cost which may occur are costs for the energy, for example. Yeah? So what we want to achieve is actually, we want to get away from this. Yeah? So we want to decentralize the computation, the actual computation, by making use of what we call so-called micro data centers. So, which means we use the computational resources which are here at the edge of the network, and provide these computational resources in a very similar manner to how virtual machines are offered in the cloud. Yeah, so. Which means instead of having here a big data center where this, for example, Apache Spark is running, we can make use of these little micro data centers close to the data. We don't have to send the data. We make use of already existing resources. The latency decreases. We don't need so much bandwidth. And use these resources to execute our services, our applications, close to the data sources. So on-site, which also means we don't have to share our data with Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and whoever. And the goal is, of course, instead of having this big data center in the cloud, we may still make use of cloud resources, however, to a way smaller degree. Because, very importantly, fog and edge computing do not aim at replacing the cloud, but rather to augment it, to supplement it with resources which are available at the edge of the network. Because for some resources, for some tasks, you always need the cloud. Yeah? For example, long-term storage of data. Yeah? If you really want to do that, the best case is actually encrypt the data and put it in the cloud, or in some other data center. Don't do a long-term data storage on-site. Yeah? So you don't do that on the robot we have seen at the very beginning. You don't do that on a single-board computer, because it's too dangerous that you will lose the data at some point of time. And for that, we make use of this basic concept of fog computing, which means
we virtualize these resources which are available at the edge of the network. So we've got a single board computer, Raspberry Pi for example, and we can make use of the single board computer in order to virtualize it and let, for example, a Docker container run on it. Yeah? So, which means we make use of the resources in a similar way like we make use of physical machines which are available in an Amazon data center, for example. Sorry. But we never see them. Yeah? So if we go to Amazon, we don't get a physical machine. We get a virtual machine. Yeah? So a virtualized view on a physical machine in a data center. And the same approach is what we use in fog computing as well. We are not interested in the actual machine, in the device. We are interested in that we've got the opportunity to run a little software container which we can use, for example, for data processing. So, and the second thing is then, these computational resources, however, of course, not as extensive as the ones we've got in the cloud. Yeah? So we've got these little micro data centers, not large ones like we can have them in the cloud. So what do we have to do? We need to make sure that these resources we've got are used in an optimal way, yeah, so that they are coordinated. Which resource is actually processing which data items from which data source and so on. So, and this is really the basic idea of fog computing. So we port well-known principles from the field of cloud computing and use them at the edge of the network. Yeah? And the edge of the network is really what you have on site, yeah? Your single board computer in your smart home, your router, your gateway, also in a company, or the robot we've seen on the shop floor. Yeah? That's the edge of the network. The core of the network is the internet. Yeah? So the internet backbone, and connected to the internet backbone, cloud data centers, of course. So, what do we do then? Yeah, we actually give the opportunity to lease and release networked IoT devices as virtual assets. I've already said that. Yeah? So, yeah, let's assume we've got here different levels. We've got the cloud. I've already said, yeah, fog computing does not aim at replacing the cloud. It's about augmenting or supplementing the cloud. Yeah, we've got data sources, which are our rectangles and rectangles and triangles, which we have here. These are our data sources. Now let's assume that this is really the level of the data sources which do not provide any computational resources at all. And in the middle, we've got our fog nodes. These are then really these are software units which are deployed on edge devices. So on a single board computer, for example, or on a single board computer, on a gateway, on a router, on your robot, whatever resource you can actually virtualize, for example, with Docker functionalities. Yeah? And then we've got something like this three-layer approach. Here on top is a cloud. Here are our data sources. In the middle, we've got our fog nodes. Yeah? So this is actually the fog part, let's say. Yeah? So what is actually the fog? The fog is nothing else as a cloud which is close to the ground. And this is what you see here as well. Yeah? So the computational resources come closer to the IoT data sources. So I've already said, however, what we can now use these fog nodes for is we simply run some services on them. Yeah, so these services could be, for example, for controlling these data sources, for processing these data sources, and so on. However, what is really important here is that we need to coordinate this a little bit. Yeah? Because if we don't have any coordination here, it might be the case that this fog node and this fog node just both process the data from these data sources because they don't know about each other. Yeah? So they both just do a connection to our data sources, to our triangles, which we see here, and then they start processing the data. We want to avoid that because this would be a waste of resources. Yeah? So we need something like a little orchestrator here, so a little unit which actually takes care of which fog node does what, processes which amount of data, controls which data sources, and so on. And as you can see here, also takes into account, okay, at what point of time do I actually need to involve the cloud? Yeah, what might be a problem here? Maybe we don't have enough computational resources at the edge of the network. Huh? So we need a virtual machine from the cloud to help us out. Yeah, and so this coordinator or this orchestrator, this orchestration control node, may then also decide which data items are actually or can actually be sent to the cloud, which data items should in any case be processed on site. No? So this is actually the very basic idea which we've got, or this is a basic idea of fog computing. No? So that we've got this middle layer which takes care of a lot of data processing in a coordinated way and involves the cloud if necessary. So we can now differentiate between different terms here, different things, and we have actually found some inspiration by biology for that. So these fog nodes, which we see here, we call them the fog cells. Yeah. So these are actually the basic units which together build the fog. Yeah. So single cells. Yeah? So they are the units which actually are able. Or these are the software units which run on a virtualized IoT device, you know, like a Raspberry Pi, for example, like a sensor node, and do something with the data. You know? So these are our fog cells. Together, the fog cells, you know, like bacteria, you know, are a fog colony. You know? So this is a unit which is controlled by one particular orchestrator, which just does what I've just said. Yeah. So. It makes sure that the fog cells, the different nodes which we've got here, do the data processing, the data storage, whatever is needed to do with the data in a coordinated way. And as I've said before, also make sure that, that, for example, virtual machines or whatever you need from the cloud are used as well if this is necessary. So this means this fog colony, which we see here, is actually equivalent. That's the wrong slide. To these micro data centers, which we've just seen. Yeah? So this is where we see this again. So a fog colony is building up such a micro data center, which we can then use to run arbitrary software. So what are now our benefits? Yeah? So what could be potential benefits of using fog computing like that? First of all, the cost. Yeah? We make use of resources which are otherwise not used. Yeah, so that might be one benefit. Of course, instead of making use of cloud resources, I've already said cloud resources are pretty cheap, but nevertheless you need to pay for them. However, if it's really a good idea to always make use of fog resources, really depends on your use case. Yeah, let's assume you've got a number of battery-driven IoT sensor nodes which have some computational power. Now the question is actually, do you really want to make use of their computational resources in order to process data? No, you don't, because this will drain the battery very, very quickly. And actually, IoT devices are usually built so to not be charged for 2 or 3 years. Yeah, and if you use the computational resources, the battery may drain within a few hours. So, and then you cannot use this sensor, this IoT device any longer. Second benefit, of course, this is all in line with the shortcomings we've just discussed for. We've just discussed for cloud computing. Lower latency. So the data is processed on-site, very close to the data sources. So instead of getting the data to the code in the cloud, we bring the code to the data. Yeah? So that the actual processing, the applications, the services are done close to the data. And as I said, these days, latency, bandwidth are actually the bottlenecks which we've got in distributed systems, not so much the computational resources any longer. Privacy and trust reasons or security reasons. Yeah, you don't need to put everything in the cloud. Yeah, so data. So and especially this might be a problem if we are talking about a public cloud hosted by Amazon, Google, or whoever. Yeah, instead, in many cases, the resources are under control of the user. Just think about your smart home. If you can actually run everything on your Raspberry Pi, that Raspberry Pi is under your control. Yeah? If you are not keen on using it any longer, you power it off. Everything is fine. Yeah? So you can delete the data if you want to. So everything is under your control. Yeah? Instead, you've got a smart home solution which is fully cloud-based. The data is actually under control of the cloud provider. Huh? So you are not in control of the data any longer. You don't know what happens to the data. This is completely not transparent. You won't see it. So we could also have some, edge cases. Let's simply assume we've got a smart city, Kiel, Hamburg, whoever, and that there we've got then units which are built or which are actually provided by the city. Yeah, then a lot of data is actually stored on these city-owned resources. Then, of course, the question is if you trust the city more than you trust Amazon or not. Yeah, so this might also be the case. Yeah, so it's not always perfect. So I hope you got a little bit of an impression of fog computing. Now comes the one slide which I really hate about my talk because there's too much text on it. Nevertheless, yeah, I want to give you one formal definition of fog computing as well. And actually, I make use of of the definition which is, comes from the so-called Open Fog Consortium. So they defined fog computing as a system-level horizontal architecture that distributes resources and services of computing, storage, control, and networking anywhere along the continuum from the cloud to the things. And two things are important here. Yeah? First of all, how do they define the fog? The fog, again, the fog also contains the cloud. Yeah? So computation resources can be used anywhere or can be provided anywhere from the cloud to the things. Huh? So, and on the other hand, it's a system-level approach. So it's more an it's not an approach you have on the communication or networking level. It's a system level, so rather on the software level which you provide. Huh? So in the Open Fog Consortium, I mean, when I started research in this area of fog computing, there were a lot of people who had very different opinions of what fog computing actually was. But the Open Fog Consortium really established this as a as the standard definition of fog computing. Interestingly, the Open Fog Consortium or the Open Fog Consortium actually has a number of really high-profile members. Yeah, so Cisco. I've already mentioned Cisco, yeah, biggest network equipment provider in the world. Intel, yeah, Microsoft, Princeton University, Dell, ARM. They are all in the Open Fog Consortium. Yeah, so this, of course, gives the consortium a lot of power, and that's the reason why they really were able to push their definition into the market. So these days, it's not called Open Fog Consortium any longer. It's called the Industrial Internet Corporation, but or consortium, I think. But nevertheless, yeah, the idea is still the same. There are a lot of powerful companies who actually defined fog computing as this. So what does now this cloud-to-sync continuum of services mean? They also define this. It enables services and applications to be distributed closer to things, what we've just seen. Yeah? Data processing happens on-site and anywhere along the continuum between cloud and things, which actually means, I've already said that as well, yeah, we may also integrate virtual machines from the cloud. That's fine. Yeah? The fog is not there to replace the cloud. It's more to supplement and embrace the cloud. And doing this on a system level, I've highlighted this as well, extend from the things over the network edges, through the cloud, and across multiple protocol layers. Yeah? So not just radio systems, not just a specific protocol layer, not just as one part of an end-to-end system, but a system which is really spanning the whole part from the things to the cloud. Yeah? So as I said before, especially not limited to the communication communication part. Yeah? And yeah, Industrial Internet Consortium, that's a new one. So now actually today, yeah, we've got around about 80 minutes left. I did not only use the term fog computing but also edge computing. Yeah? And actually back in the old days, yeah, so 5 years ago at the very start of fog computing, a lot of people actually said, or a lot of companies actually said, that's pretty much the same. Fog and edge computing actually means the same. Yeah, but since then, the definitions or also the understanding has changed a little bit. Yeah, so nevertheless, if at some later point, for example, in the lecture of Olaf Landsiedel, or if you're when you're doing your master's thesis or whatever, if you're reading papers on fog computing and edge computing, you may actually read papers and see, okay, they actually mean the same. Yeah, so this happened until 2017, even 2018, quite often. However, here and following this this definition of the Open Fog Consortium or the Industrial Internet Consortium, I actually define fog as cloud plus the edge plus the software. Huh? So the edge of the network is really what is on-site. Yeah, so a router, a gateway. But this is not everything in the fog. Yes, the fog also embraces the cloud. So all of these things need to be seen together. So edge computing, on the other hand, is computing at the edge of the network. So this means the path between the data sources and the internet core, so the cloud. Yeah? So let's assume you've got your smartphone. That's a typical edge device. So, and let's assume in the future we are all cyborgs and have some body sensors, and you make use of an app running on your smartphone to get the data from your body sensors, so blood pressure, heart rate, yeah, whatever, temperature, whatever body sensors you've got. And everything is computed here on site in your smartphone. Then I would actually call this edge computing, because everything happens on the edge, or at the edge. Yeah? However, if that app then uses the cloud in order to store data, then it would be fog computing, because then you you combine resources in the cloud and at the edge of the network. Yeah? So is anybody a user of Runtastic? Nobody? Does anybody know who that is, what that is? Yes? Okay, good. So Runtastic is the only Austrian unicorn startup. Yeah. So what they actually did was they had an app for your smartphone, and if you're a runner and later on a bicyclist and whatever, you could actually use that to track your sports, your sport activities. Yeah? So it was all done actually on site in your edge in your smartphone. So you were actually wearing, for example, a strap belt to get your heart rate, for example, and the belt would actually send this data to the smartphone. So you would see in your smartphone, okay, today I was very quick, but my heart rate was too high, and it would actually give you some hints on how to work out better. Yeah, sorry. So, typical case of edge computing. Yeah? So everything was done on site. There were the sensors which you're wearing on your body, and everything stored in your app. Yeah? So edge computing. Of course, downside, if somebody, if you lose your phone, yeah, all the data is on the phone. It's gone. Oh, so that's, of course, the downside of it. So at some point, 3 years ago, Runtastic was bought by Adidas. Yeah? And Adidas thought, oh, well, yeah, so we actually want to exploit the data from all the runners who make use of our nice new tool, Runtastic. So what they actually do these days, everything is stored in the cloud. So the app is only used to connect to the sensors, and then the app is sending everything to the cloud. Yeah? So all the calculations, everything is done in the cloud. People don't like that. But that would, for example, be a typical use case of fog computing. Yeah? So, because there you've got the combination of sensor, edge device, and the cloud somewhere. Yeah? So this is also, actually exemplifying the differences between fog and edge computing. So, and I've already said that, I think. Yeah. So, I was a little bit too quick. Sorry about that. So we already know that. Yeah, smartphone which processes data from IoT devices, from IoT body sensors, for example, edge devices. Also, your gateway in the smart home, your Raspberry Pi, you use that to process everything on site, no cloud involved. That's also edge computing. So now I've talked about rather simplistic fog devices, but especially for these use cases like robotics, remember the example we had at the very beginning, so sensor nodes, gateways, routers, a single board computer like a Raspberry Pi may not offer enough computational resources to actually carry out all the computations which are needed. Yeah? And therefore, companies actually started 2 to 3 years ago to actually provide special fog devices which you can deploy at the edge. And these are now very, very powerful devices. Yeah? So the AWS Snowball Edge is one example. Yeah, the TT Tech Nerf is another one. Yeah, it's an Austrian company, that's why I use it. It's actually not very big, as you can see here from the Ethernet ports. Yeah, so, but it's very, very powerful. And the basic idea of this is now that you deploy that on site, yeah, so for example, in your factory, on your factory shop floor, and use that in order to run applications on site, that you don't need the cloud. Now, the good thing about the TTTech Nerve, for example, is that in fact you may use these, you may integrate that with the cloud if you want to, but you don't have to. With the Amazon AWS Snowball Edge, it's of course completely the opposite. Yeah, this is a device which you could, for example, if you're a researcher and you go to do field tests, yeah, where you don't have internet connectivity or you're doing some experiments which generate a lot of data in a very brief amount of time. Yeah, then you take the Snowball Edge with you. It's actually, you can just carry it. It's actually quite, it has a hard case, so it will not break. You can really take that to areas where the environment is rather rough. Yeah? And you use it, you connect all your sensors, everything you've got in the field to the device, and then you take your Snowball Edge with you back to your lab, connect it to the internet, and it will automatically become a virtual machine in your Amazon Web Service environment. Yeah, so you simply use this one like a virtual machine. Very nice to be integrated. However, of course, all proprietary solutions, and it's a closed solution in the Amazon world. Yeah? So this is also possible. So these are really, as I said, powerful edge devices which you can use in fog environments to process large amounts of data. Yeah, for example, the Snowball Edge has 100 terabyte of storage, yeah, because it's really used to actually store a lot of big amounts of data, then take these big amounts of data to the lab, integrate it, use all of the other virtual machines from the Amazon cloud, and then process the data. What you can also do these days, yeah, another solution or another example from Amazon, is that you make use of a special solution which they call Amazon Web Services IoT Greengrass, which is some kind of a gateway between the Internet of Things, so what you've got on site, and the Amazon cloud again. So the basic idea here, I'm sure you cannot read that at the very end, but I only want you to get the basic idea. Yeah? So you've got devices, yeah, so IoT devices, data sources. You want to get the data from these devices into the cloud, or you want to pre-process it at the edge of the network. Huh? What you then got is the Greengrass core, which you can install, for example, on a Raspberry Pi. It's a quite lightweight middleware, so it's not so much of a big problem to do that. And what's the Greengrass core? So this is now your Raspberry Pi actually does is it integrates the data from all of these IoT devices, so what we've got here, and may do some pre-processing of the data or processing of the data, that's also possible, and it automatically integrates your devices with the cloud. And Amazon, I've stolen this picture from Amazon, but of course we are talking here about the Amazon cloud. Again, Amazon doesn't want you to use any other solution. They want to keep you in there. Yeah? So this is also a solution which Amazon, for example, offers you in order to get your IoT data into their cloud to be processed. Yeah, so this is also possible. And this is then actually also a fog computing solution, because we combine resources at the edge of the network with resources in the cloud. However, a lot of the benefits I was just talking about, yeah, that you don't have to trust Amazon or so on, don't count here any longer. Yeah, because obviously here you need to trust Amazon again. So Amazon IoT Greengrass Core is primarily a very nice solution to get the data. To get data into the cloud. So last but not least, I want to finish my talk today with giving you a brief overview of research I'm doing in this area. Just 5 minutes of your time. So a lot of what you have seen today are generic concepts. Yeah, you already see solutions for that, you can, but it's not like you can build or you can buy something like a fog these days. So it's still ongoing research, ongoing technical work in this area. So, and one of the projects working in this area is actually the FORA project, where I'm also part of, which stands for Fog Computing for Robotics and Industrial Automation. Has now run for around about 2.5 years. So we started in 2017, actually it's some kind of a doctoral college which is European-wide. Yeah, so it's the so-called international training network, which means we've got 15 PhD students at 7 different sites all over Europe, including 3 PhD students at TU Wien and one of them in my group. And here what we actually do is we really take into account what should fog computing look like in the future, which functionalities do we need to realize this, especially, as you can see from the name, with regard to robotics and industrial automation. Yeah, we've got also a number of partners which do not receive funding, for example, ABB and other large companies, so they don't receive funding, but they help in training the students. And it's actually coordinated by the Technical University of Denmark, yeah, so in Copenhagen. Yeah, so, what do we actually do in Fora? Very similar to what I've discussed today. Huh? So in Fora, we also come from the edge part. Yeah? So what do we have in industrial automation, in the industrial internet at the edge of the network? We've got robots. We've got, this is, for example, conveyor belt. This is some kind of a machine. This is also a little kind of a robot. Yeah? And all of these are data sources. So, and what we do in Fora is actually we investigate how can we now make use, or how can we actually make sure that we can process these, the data coming from these sources. And we've got one particular focus, which is real-time processing, because this is something which is pretty new, because fog computing so far is not really able to work on in the with latencies of, let's say, 2-3 milliseconds, or maybe in the nanoseconds area. Yeah? So, and what do we do for that? So we've got here our edge of the network. Yeah, we've got our devices, we've got our data sources. So what we want to do is we actually want to build an operating system which can be used by an application developer to integrate the data from these different sources and process it. And without going into too much detail, for that we came up with this concept of a fog node. You've seen the fog node earlier today, which is actually able to run apps, an arbitrary app very close to the data sources, also to integrate data coming from these different sources. Yeah, so as you can see here, this is fog node. You can run arbitrary apps on it as long as enough computational power is available. And you can also, what also runs on a fog node is called fog software manager, so depicted here in green, which actually provides you with the whole environment to run apps in, next to the machines. So, and last but not least, again, here we've got the cloud. Yeah? Fog computing is about combining what is happening at the edge and combining what is taking place in the cloud. Yeah, so which means such a fog node may also have the capabilities to actually integrate apps which are running in the cloud or store data in the cloud and so on. Why do we do that? For example, to achieve fault tolerance. So let's simply assume we've got here our robot. The robot has a fog node. Yeah, the computational resources are available here. And then they break down. We cannot use the computational resources any longer. What can we then use? Yeah? What can we then do? In theory, you could say, okay, this doesn't look good. We cannot use this robot any longer. But what could we do instead? As long as the data source, let's say the data pipeline is still operating, we can simply send the data to the cloud. Yeah? So we don't want that in every case. We've talked about the benefits and shortcomings of cloud computing compared to fog computing today, but this might be a good fallback solution in some cases. It's for sure better than not using the robot, because the working hour of a robot is pretty, pretty expensive. So, this said, I'm coming to my summary for today. So, what did we discuss today? First of all, I try to motivate why we need something like data processing, fog and edge computing, maybe cloud computing for robotics, and of course IoT in general, because a lot of what you've seen today can be applied to IoT devices in general. Yeah, it does not only apply to robots. Yeah? And we've discussed, okay, one thing what we could do is actually making use of the cloud. And however, this notion that cloud computing is the facilitator for data processing and data storage in IoT settings, I hope, please take this home with you, that I was able to show that this might not be the best idea in any case. So, On the other hand, what have we seen as well? Fog computing as a different approach, allowing to also make use resources which are available at the edge of the network. This said, I'd like to thank you a lot for your attention. And if there are no further questions, I usually say, we see each other next week, but I guess that will not be the case here. I hope that you enjoyed the lecture, and maybe we will see each other at some point in the future. Thanks a lot.